and he and my mother reconnected, as they say. It was a fling. She wrote to my father as soon as she learned she was pregnant and told him everything. He was a very understanding man. He loved her, though I imagine my existence strained things. She wrote to Jamie, too, but he was already dead. So, eventually, she wrote to Marion, but the letter took a while to find her. I said, I watched that documentary about your project with the sunken boats. Boat-like objects. Was that about Jamie? I didn't want to think so at the time. I called it sea change. Do you know that verse from The Tempest? Full fathom five thy father lies. I didn't know. Of his bones are coral made, she said. Those are pearls that were his eyes. Nothing of him that doth fade, but doth suffer a sea change into something rich and strange. She smiled wryly. You can't help being seduced by the image. I think it's less about the body, and more about how our imagination does its best to contend with death, and fails. I thought about holding the Cessna's yoke in my hands like it was a bomb. I thought about crashing a fake plane into a fake ocean, the fade to black. I asked, what was Caleb like? Charming. Drank a little too much. I only spent a few days with him. He could be boisterous and then suddenly cloud over. He'd clearly loved Marion, but he didn't seem like the loss had devastated him. Sometimes he even talked about her in the present tense, which made me wonder if he'd ever really internalized her death. Or maybe he'd just known so many people who died. I don't know. He and I talked more about Jamie than Marion. Like I said, though, you should look up Joey Kamaka. He might know more. I still don't understand why me, though. Why don't you want to do it? Why do you think I should? It's not the way I look for truth, personally, piecing information together. It depresses me. But that doesn't mean I'm not interested in the truth. As far as why you, I don't know that either. It's just an idea that got into my head. The connections appeal to me. You playing Marion. Your parents. She lifted the document box onto her footstool, removed the lid. Take a look. I might run to the bathroom first, I told her. Where is it? I was thinking I'd pee and then just go right out the front door, not look back, not take on the responsibility of deciding what to do with whatever was in the letters, not continue on as some pawn in Adelaide's art installation. But when I came out of the bathroom, revving up for my escape, there, on the wall, staring back at me, was Marion Graves. The original of the charcoal portrait I'd seen pinned up on the costume designer's inspiration wall. Strange that it was real. An actual object in the world. Something that could be framed and hung up. Her brother's hand had made those lines, had summoned her face from a blank page. I felt the abrupt onset of what can only be described as a hunch. There was something more that could be known, and I wanted to know it. There was something in Adelaide's document box, and there was something beyond that, out in the void. I felt this like I'd felt the presence of the gigantic snowy landscape while I'd kissed Redwood. I went back to the living room. There's some guy who surfaces every few years to say he's spotted what might be the peregrine in satellite images of Antarctica, or that he's found stuff on remote sub-Antarctic islands that might be clues, bits of wreckage, or an old lipstick tube he says is Marion's, or some bit of bone, he says, might be human and might be Eddie's. And he promises that if people will just send him enough money, he'll go down there and solve the mystery once and for all. He 100% promises he will. Maybe I was turning into that guy. Maybe I was like the handful of wannabe sleuths who post blurry old photos online they claim are of Marion and Eddie in Australia in the 1950s, or of the Peregrine refitted as a cargo DC-3 in the Congo. Maybe I was like the flat earthers who think Antarctica is an ice wall around the Earth's perimeter and believe the Peregrine was shot down by the Air Force to stop Marion from discovering the truth. They all had hunches, too. They all desperately needed to feel like truth-tellers, to believe in their breakthroughs and revelations. Maybe I was a crackpot or a charlatan. Maybe I was just trying to insert myself into an inscrutable, long-concluded drama. Or maybe the past had something to tell me. I sat on Adelaide's couch and wearily, almost against my will, reached for the box of letters.
The flight. Where to begin? At the beginning, of course. But where is the beginning? I don't know where in the past to insert a marker that says, here. Here is where the flight began. Because the beginning is in memory, not on a map. Marion Graves. From The Sea, the Sky, the Birds Between. The Lost Logbook of Marion Graves. Published by D. Wenceslaus and Sons, New York, 1959. New York City, 40 degrees 45 minutes north, 73 degrees 58 minutes west. April 15th, 1948. 0 nautical miles flown. Matilda Pfeiffer, nearly 70, 10 years a widow, walks at a clip along 42nd Street. She wears all black. Not to mark her widowhood, but because she likes the severity. Narrow black skirt, nipped-in black jacket with an enamel brooch of a leopard on the lapel. Black pumps, black beret over steel-gray bob, enormous round glasses with heavy black frames. One bony hand, flashing with rings and bracelets, holds a tiny frothy white dog against her chest. When Lloyd died, no one had been more surprised than Matilda to learn that her husband had left her not only the entirety of his fortune, but also as much authority over his businesses as he could bequeath, to freely do with as she sees fit. Clifford, her second son, an incompetent, had been the only one to rant and rage, perhaps because he knew he was the least deserving of the four living Pfeiffer boys. Lloyd, more sentimental than she, had let Clifford be at least nominally in charge of their shipping interests, which, even well insulated from real power, he'd made a hash of. So she had fired him as soon as she could. She hadn't put him out on the street, of course, but had given him a great deal of money, warned him there would be no more, and encouraged him to go abroad somewhere and embrace a life of relatively economical debauchery. She suspected Lloyd had left her in charge partly because he'd known she would do the things he could not bear to. Clifford had moved to St. Thomas and married a Caribbean girl and had 3 children with her. But Matilda refused to give him the satisfaction of being scandalized. Henry, the oldest and brightest of her sons, had already been a vice president of Liberty Oil before Lloyd's death. This was by far their largest company. And she'd left well enough alone. 46 now, he was married to a woman Matilda didn't disdain and had 4 sons of his own. Bless Henry. Robert, 3rd in line, also worked at Liberty Oil. He was neither brilliant nor burdensome, was polite in company but did not shine, had never married though he was 43. She suspected Robert might be a queer. Next would have come Leander, whatever sort of man he might have been if not for diphtheria. Then there was George, dear Georgie, the baby, grown from the dark soil of her grief for Leander, only 24 when Lloyd died, her only son to go to war, now finishing up his doctorate in geology at Columbia, married to a nice girl and with 2 children. Her gratitude he'd survived the Pacific felt as boundless as the cosmos. She could not have endured losing another son. And the war had killed Lloyd, she knew. Germany had invaded Poland in September 1939, and he'd died days later at 74 of a heart attack on his way to work. Matilda suspected his heart simply couldn't withstand the magnitude of fury he'd felt at his father's country. So many women in black veils at his funeral. Matilda had tried to sort out which had been her husband's mistresses, but had given up in rueful exasperation. It had taken some months for her to sort out Lloyd's complex financial interests, fighting off incursions by rivals as she went. When she felt she had a firm grasp, she sold off some assets and reorganized others. And then she'd gone out and bought herself a struggling publishing house, D. Wenceslaus & Sons. "Why books?" Henry had asked. "Why not philanthropy? I know plenty of boards that would love to have you." "I like books," she'd said. "I don't care for boards." Furthermore, she'd given birth to 5 sons and spent nearly 40 years with a philanderer, and was now free to do whatever she liked. Maybe that was why Lloyd had left her in charge. Maybe he'd been making one of his oblique apologies. After Pearl Harbor, it had been her idea to print thousands of cheap paperbacks off the Wenceslaus backlist and donate them to the troops. The gesture was one of genuine goodwill, but as she'd thought might happen, the boys hadn't stopped wanting books after they came home. Sales were strong. Thanks partly to her, paperbacks weren't considered trashy anymore, just affordable and convenient. She lives in an apartment near Bryant Park, and it is from there she has come when she swings abruptly off 42nd Street and through the glass doors of the building that houses Wenceslaus headquarters. From the elevator, she marches directly to her office, ignoring the greetings from the secretaries and typists that rise up like cheeps from birds' nests. She'd chosen an office on the 5th floor with the editors, not the 4th floor with the sales and numbers types, and some of them can be glimpsed through their half-open doors, always reading. Sometimes reading and talking on the telephone simultaneously. "She hasn't canceled, has she?" Matilda asks her secretary, Shirley, who has followed her into her office. She tosses her beret onto a bookshelf and dumps the dog, Pigeon, unceremoniously onto the floor. On all available surfaces, piles of books rise above a general mess of paper. String-tied manuscripts, mock-ups of covers, clippings, correspondence. Shirley sets down a silver bowl of water for Pigeon, retrieves the beret and places it carefully atop the hat stand. "No, not yet." Not long after Lloyd died, Matilda had found herself wondering about Addison Graves. She had a vague memory of Lloyd telling her Addison had been released from Sing Sing, but after that, nothing. There didn't seem to be anyone to ask. Even the longest-serving employees at L&O had no idea, and the lawyer, Chester Fine, was dead. When Addison was in prison, Lloyd had gradually stopped mentioning him. Matilda had taken the end of their friendship as a natural, sorrowful consequence of the loss of the Josephina, and the uncertainty surrounding the dispersal of blame. Perhaps the courageous thing would have been for Lloyd to defend Addison more vocally, but he'd had an entire company to think about, thousands of employees. And what of the passengers and crew who drowned? Certainly their families required a, not a scapegoat. Certainly they deserved justice. That Addison's odd young wife had perished was a tragedy, but at least the children had been saved. "He never told you?" Henry said, inexplicably aghast. They were alone in the Liberty Oil offices, sitting opposite each other at a table heaped with files and ledgers. "Told me what?" And so Henry had relayed what his father had confessed about the smuggled crates of bullets and shells and nitrocellulose, about how Lloyd, almost beyond a shadow of a doubt, had been the one responsible for the ship's loss, but had allowed Addison to take the fall. "He made little attempts to set things right," Henry said, "but he would never come clean publicly, which was probably the only thing that would have mattered to Addison Graves. Sending that cargo was beyond foolish. It wouldn't even have made a real difference to the war effort, of course. It was a symbolic gesture. And then he had to be ashamed until he died." Matilda stared at her son. After some time, she said, "What happened to the children?" "They were sent to their uncle, weren't they? In Wyoming?" "Minnesota, I think." "Do we have the address somewhere?"
"I suppose, somewhere."
A cautious glance.
"Why?"
"I'd like to do something for them. I don't know what."
"We might not be able to find them. They're grown."
"I'd like to try."
"I'm not sure we want to dredge this back up."
"Henry," she said, hitting him with the full force of her reproof. By the time an old address for Wallace Graves in Missoula, Montana was turned up, 1939 had become 1940. Germany occupied Denmark, Norway, Holland, Belgium, France. Matilda wrote a letter, sent it off. No reply came, but neither was the letter returned. She wrote again. Throughout the war, she wrote every few months, always saying more or less the same thing. She was trying to locate the children of Addison and Annabel Graves because she would like to know what had become of them and to make some attempt to repay a debt. In 1945, she stopped writing. In 1947, she received a reply. And now, Shirley is tapping on the door, showing in a tall, thin, blonde, watchful woman in wool slacks and a long, unbelted cotton coat. And Pigeon is yapping and skittering around.
"Hush,"
Matilda says, scooping him up, offering her hand to Marion. Marion has a strong grip. She appears older than she is, which must be 33 or 34, a little older than Georgie. Her face shows lines made by squinting and worrying, and she has an aura of experience about her. The boniness of her father's face has survived in her, but like her mother, she has unusually pale hair and eyes, both bleached like things left too long in the sun.
"Tea? Coffee?" Shirley says. "May I take your coat?"
"No, thank you," says Marion.
"You certainly look the part," says Matilda.
"What part?"
"Shut the door, please, Shirley," says Matilda.
When they are alone, sitting on opposite sides of her desk, she says,
"Well, here we are."
Marion looks around the office but does not speak. Matilda is not afraid of silence and waits until Marion says, "I'd never been on an airliner before."
"And?"
"It was all right. Strange to be cargo. Thank you for the ticket." She shifts in her chair, crossing her legs, which are so long Matilda wonders where she finds slacks that fit. It wasn't necessary. Matilda waves this away, and vigilant, dim-witted Pigeon barks at the clatter of her bracelets. To appease him, she takes an open tin of smoked mussels from a drawer and feeds him one off a fork. In her letters, Marion is not given to elaboration, but they have been correspondence long enough that Matilda knows about the deaths of Jamie and Wallace, and about the brief, long-ago visit and subsequent disappearance of Addison. She feels no further need to discuss the past, though she has decided that, if the moment presents itself, she will tell the truth about the explosives in the Josephina's belly. In her early letters, she'd simply asked questions. Later, she told Marion, she had come to believe her family, the Pfeiffers, owed the Graves family a significant debt. She was vague about its nature. Let Marion infer she simply felt bad about Addison's fate. And she intended to make some settlement. As the original form of the debt was not monetary, she wrote, its erasure was not possible, but money was what she had, what she could offer. No, Marion had written back. She did not want money. I learned the hard way that patronage can be dangerous. What then, Matilda asked, do you want? You would be doing me a kindness to accept my offer. In allowing me to lessen my burden of guilt, you would be the benefactor, not I. A month had passed before she received Marion's reply. I've considered your question, and what I want is to fly around the world north-south, over the poles. It had never been done. It would be very difficult and dangerous, perhaps impossible. She would need money, yes, enough to buy a suitable airplane and modify it and to pay a navigator to come with her, among other expenses. She would need fuel, a lot of it, which she imagined Liberty Oil would be in a position to supply, and she would need that fuel to be waiting for her in remote places, which she imagined Liberty Oil could reach. She would also need assistance in securing the necessary permissions and support. Come to New York, Matilda had responded. I would like to meet you. We can talk more. And here Marion is. Somehow this guarded woman is the same entity as one of the bundles in Addison's arms in the newspaper photos, being carried down the gangway from the rescue ship. Matilda sees no point in small talk. I've decided to help you with your flight. But I have a question. Marion turns wary. All right. Don't look so put out. Answering a question seems like a small concession. I thought you said you were the one who owes me. Not antagonistic, but not playful either. Marion's body is relaxed, but the fact that she is still wearing her coat implies she might leave at any moment. Matilda sets Pigeon on the floor, pushes aside the tin of mussels. It might get tiresome to continually evaluate who owes whom. I was hoping we could be something more like collaborators. Marion gives a slight tilt of her head that Matilda decides to take as a nod. Matilda says, I want to know why. Why what? Why do this flight, of course? Matilda ticks off her fingers as she talks. As you say yourself, it's very dangerous. Arguably, it's pointless, too. They've been to the poles. They've drawn all the maps. There's nothing left to discover. It's the most absurd idea, really. Even if you miraculously survive, you're buying a one-way ticket to exactly where you started. She sits back. So, why? Marion looks annoyed. That question doesn't interest me. You mean you don't know the answer?
Not exactly. You don't know exactly, or that's not exactly what you mean?
Both. The second one.
People will want to know why.
What people?
If you do it, I thought you might write a book.
Marion laughs. I couldn't write a book. Anyone can write a book with a little help. I wouldn't know what to say. Matilda fetches a stack of hardbacks from a shelf, sets them on her desk in front of Marion. Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, Beryl Markham, Amelia Earhart, Charles Lindbergh, though he is included grudgingly, as she has not forgiven his admiration of the Nazis.
You've read these?
Marion turns her head sideways, reading the titles.
Yes.
Then you know what to say. Write what you see, what you think, what happens. It's not terrifically complicated.
The experience is the thing. You. Not some imaginary line on the globe.
If the book catches on, other avenues will open up.
Lecture tours.
They might even make a film about you. Marion looks caught between amusement and alarm. Maybe I'd like to keep myself to myself. Matilda made a pfft sound.
Don't pretend you're so modest and naive.
If you were, you wouldn't want to do a stunt like this. Marion sits back.
I have a question for you, too.
By all means.
It's the same as yours.
Why?
I've told you. I'm trying to atone.
For what? What is this debt you talked about?
Here is the moment, so conspicuous now it has arrived.
Matilda explains how Lloyd's dislike for his own father had fueled his hatred of Germany. In a steady voice, she relays what Henry had told her about the crates on the Josephina.
Your father didn't know, she says,
not explicitly.
I didn't either,
but I think I should have guessed. I didn't want to know. That much is clear.
Marion's face has tightened in concentration.
Matilda can imagine her wearing a similar expression while flying through a storm.
I'm not sure what to think about this, Marion says. I think mostly I'm relieved to know what happened.
Aren't you angry?
I was so angry.
I might have been at other times, but it was so long ago.
Your life would have been very different.
Yes, but I can't know how. After a long pause, Matilda decides to return to the business at hand.
What would the next step be for your flight?
Finding the right plane. Marion turns eager, leaning forward. I think a surplus Dakota is the best possibility. They made thousands of them. They're almost indestructible. They can land anywhere, and it's not hard to put skis on them. In the war, they'd have a bigger crew, but I think I could do it with just a navigator. With auxiliary tanks, you'd have the range, too, though barely, and that's assuming I could refuel twice in Antarctica, which is a problem, but I think not an insurmountable one. On the Ross Sea side, there's cached fuel, but on the other, that I haven't figured out yet. It might make sense to look for a plane in Australia or New Zealand and start the flight down there. I've been thinking through different scenarios. It's a question of sneaking in between the seasons. The Arctic is less of a problem than the Antarctic. She has become animated, gesturing at an imaginary map, but catches herself, subsides warily. There's still a lot to sort out. Another silence. Something carefully stretched between them to test its strength. Matilda nods.
All right.
Marion looks at her questioningly.
Let's get a plane,
Matilda says. They talk for another hour, form the beginnings of a plan, poke around the edges of a formidable list of tasks. When Marion stands to leave, Matilda rises too, hands her a canvas-bound book. Marion flips through the blank pages, yellow paper gridded with pale blue squares. What's this?
It's for you to write in.
Write what in?
Write about the flight.
Marion closes the book, holds it out. I already have a logbook.
Call it whatever you want, a journal, a diary. Call it the Enchanted Chronicles of Marion Almighty, for all I care. Don't tie yourself in knots over it. Just write down what happens, and you can decide later what to do with it.
She surprises herself with her own earnestness as she reaches up to grip Marion's shoulders, shakes her gently as she says,
You must do everything you can to remember. Not just what you see, but what it means to you.
Why go at all? I have no answer beyond my certainty that I must. Marion Graves. Long Beach, California, 33 degrees 47 minutes north, 118 degrees 7 minutes west, June 30th, 1949, 0 nautical miles flown. The fleeting golden moment between afternoon and evening. The sun hanging peaceably in the western sky, warming the broad, pale beach and the wooden roller coaster and palm-lined promenade. The tidy ranks of small houses stretching inland among green-crowned trees. The sprawled figure of Marion Graves lying on her back in the overgrown grass behind her rented bungalow. A book rests open and face down on her belly. It is the blank journal Matilda Pfeiffer had given her a year ago. A breeze ruffles her close cap of hair, soft and fine and so pale it is almost greenish, like the fluff inside an artichoke. She checks her watch, holding her wrist above her face. 6:17. Eddie had said he would drive himself from Florida. He was in the mood for a journey. You'd better be, Marion had replied over the crackling long-distance line. The flight would be 23,000 nautical miles, give or take. In a letter, now 3 weeks old, he'd told her that he would arrive on this day, June 30th, at 6:30 in the evening, and as he is a navigator, she'd taken him at his word. She rolls onto her side, smooths the book flat, takes up the pen. She writes only rarely and tentatively when she does, letting stray thoughts catch in the pages like crumbs. She's surprised she writes at all. She can't imagine her little scribbles, and they are scribbles, her handwriting is awful, ever making a real book. But some inconsistent, unplumbable impulse keeps nudging her to pick up the pen. I've thought more than I should about whether it would be possible to do the flight alone. It's an absurd idea, but I still pick at the question until reason puts its foot down and says, No, you cannot. I mean, no insult to Eddie. No person in the world would be fully welcome. The idea of going alone should terrify me, because going alone would mean death. But when I imagine it, I feel no fear, only wistful longing. Does that mean I wish to die? I don't think I do. But the pure and absolute solitude in which we leave the world exerts a pull. I suppose I think a solo flight would be the purest possible attempt. But why? There is Matilda's question again. The reason sits there like a pebble just out of reach. Inert and nondescript and insignificant. Interesting only in its inaccessibility. Or maybe the problem is that I want no navigator but Eddie. And also, I never want to face Eddie. A car horn sounds 3 times, quick and bright. What had been her last words to Ruth at the Polygon Hotel? She doesn't remember, clearly.
The sedative pills from the medic at Caleb's camp had been powerful, but she has a horrible dread they had been go away. Grief had made her cruel. She'd needed to hurt Ruth, to make her see she wanted Caleb instead, to drive her off. Jamie's death had seemed like direct punishment for her having been foolish and selfish enough to enjoy her corner of the war, her freedom in it. And Ruth could never be disentangled from that. Marion had written back to Ruth's letter, but she'd taken too long. The envelope was returned. In September 1944, in North Carolina, Ruth's plane had caught fire on takeoff and crashed.
"She died,"
Zip told Marion and Hamble.
"I'm sorry. I know you two were close."
Marion had stared at Zip, waiting to be overcome, but felt only pressure and heaviness. Then, nothing. Jamie's death had rent and torn her in such a way that she was no longer watertight. Her emotions drained out, leaving her empty. So passed her grief for Ruth. She was too ruined to hold it. Guilt, though, lingered. For the first time since she'd started flying, she found no solace in being airborne. She picked up her chits, collected her planes, took them where she was told. Her own existence oppressed her. After Caleb left with the invasion force, she had started saving money without knowing why. She took the bus instead of riding her motorbike. She left the Polygon Hotel for cheaper digs. Once the Germans began to retreat, she started getting ferry assignments to Europe and devised a minor smuggling operation. If she was flying to Belgium, she would leave her parachute behind and instead fill its bag with tins of cocoa, which wasn't rationed in England, but was in short supply for the liberated Belgian bakers. She would sell the cocoa and buy things that were rationed or unavailable in England, sugar, clothes, leather goods, and then sell those on the black market in Britain. After Ruth died, she understood why she was saving up. She didn't want her old life, but she couldn't imagine a new one. The money was to buy time in between. As soon as she opens the door, Eddie grabs her up and swings her like the pendulum of a gigantic bell, back and forth, tolling. When he sets her back on her feet, she squints against the sun's glare, trying to see if he's changed. It's been 6 years. He touches her shorn head with a big, gentle hand.
"Look at this.
You're 2 minutes early.
My watch must be fast."
"That's yours." A royal blue convertible Cadillac coupe gleams at the curb, top down. Its buffed, elongated curves look like they've been formed by the wind.
"Homecoming present to myself. I got a deal from an old friend. I'm getting rid of it before we leave."
She catches a trace of sadness on his face.
"No, don't. Put it in storage." "No, I don't want her to get lonely. Here, let me get my bags."
In the house, they babble too brightly about things that have only just happened. The past so recently traversed, it's still unsettled, as though by a wake. His square, horsey face and long, sturdy forearms are tan. He'd lingered on the drive, he says, followed whims and detours. He has his same old affable charm, but something is different. Something nebulous but pervasive. He reminds her of a statue that has been broken and glued back together, its shape the same but its surface spiderwebbed with cracks. She talks about flying cargo to keep in practice. She's always at the bottom of the roster, has been told she can't fly passengers because the idea of a female pilot makes people nervous. None of it matters. Not her thousands of hours, not the Spitfires and Hurricanes and Wellington bombers she'd flown, not her landings on high glaciers and frozen lakes and narrow sandbars. But so far, the cargo hasn't complained that she's a woman. The engines and hydraulics she's worked on haven't minded. She has her mechanics license now, too. Had he heard? Helen Ritchie killed herself back in January. Pills. They say she did it because she couldn't get any flying work. He hadn't heard. He remembered Ruth had liked Helen. The first mention of Ruth, made so casually. She shows him into the bedroom, tells him it's his. She will hear none of his protests. She herself will sleep on the couch. She insists. You couldn't fit half yourself on that couch, she says. I don't want to displace you. She is already moving away down the hall. Come see the war room. It had been a small second bedroom when she moved in, and she'd enlisted the landlord to help her carry the bed out to the garage.
What if your mother comes to visit?
The landlord had said from his end of the mattress, walking backward.
Or a friend?
He seemed like a nice man. Bushy eyebrows and heavy jowls, a Hawaiian shirt patterned with hula girls. I don't have a mother, she told him, and he'd left it alone. Maps paper the walls and bury the small dining table her landlord had loaned her. Rolled charts stand dense as bamboo in crates and wastebaskets. There is a general shambles of heaped up paper, checklists, invoices, aerial photos, notes on winds and weather, inventories, catalogs, letters of advice, survival manuals, correspondence with Navy contacts, correspondence with Norwegian explorers and whalers, correspondence with the leaders of the Norwegian, British, Swedish, Antarctic expedition, which will carry fuel for her, lists of radio stations and beacons, correspondence and contracts with Liberty Oil, order forms for airplane parts, addresses and phone numbers of contacts in all the places where they might need contacts, paperwork for visas, scraps and scribbles, and on and on and on and on.
Dear God, Eddie says.
There's an underlying order.
Chaos doesn't count as its own form of order.
A sea trunk resides in the near corner, and she clears papers from its lid, opens it to show him. Brown fur inside, like the humped back of an animal.
Are we bringing a dead bear?
She extracts a hooded parka, matching trousers, fur boots. Reindeer, there's nothing better in the cold. We'll get you a set to match in Alaska.
Nanook and Nanook take to the skies. By the way, I've been studying up on the high latitude stuff. A guy I knew in the war is in Fairbanks with a recon squadron. He sent me a manual and some charts as long as I promised not to sell them to the Russians.
Eddie wanders over to the largest map on the wall. A Mercator projection of the world with the Pacific centered, the Americas to the right and the rest of the continents hanging heavy to the left. On it, Marion has penciled their route.
I wanted to talk to you before I inked it in, she says, following him.
He makes a noncommittal noise, leans close to study the penciled line, the bits of land it connects. He touches the empty ocean below Cape Town.
They don't even bother including Antarctica. I don't know how you could, really, on a flat map. Sometimes there's a sliver of white, isn't there? Just to remind people it exists.
From the mess on the table, she extracts a map of Antarctica, mostly blank, only a few scattered elevations marked, a few patches of mountains. There's this. She swivels around, surveying the room. I have some better charts somewhere.
I thought you said there was an underlying order?
Sometimes it underlies more deeply than I'd like. Eddie studies the white shape. Finally, he says,
what have you got around here to drink?
They take gin and tonics outside, brush leaves from the cushioned chaises at the edge of the grass. She pulls a lime from her neighbor's tree that hangs over the fence, carves slices from it with a pocket knife. He clinks her glass.
To friends reunited.
They drink. The golden light has gone. She can't think what to say, where to start. They have never been together without Ruth, and her absence hangs between them, a void but also the thing that spans it. You know, he says, I actually have the jitters. Don't you feel like we're newlyweds or something? In an arranged marriage? I was nervous to see you. I didn't know if it would be the same. It won't be. Nothing is. But now you won't be rid of me for months and months. How's the plane?
In the spring, she had gone to Auckland. She'd walked down a row of six superficially identical war surplus Dakotas, snub-nosed and jungle green. But one had stood out plainly and obviously. She'd recognized it immediately as hers. Some wear and tear, she says to Eddie, but nothing major. It was in New Guinea, mostly.
Have you named it?
I wanted to wait for you, but I was thinking Peregrine. He nods, satisfied.
I like it. An hour into our arranged marriage, and already we're parents.
The affection she feels for him is a relief, confirmation that not everything from before is gone or irreversibly damaged. She had not been sure she could trust her memory of how much she had liked him. Eddie, she says, I wanted to thank you.
For what?
For agreeing to come.
I'm flattered you asked.
No, really, I'm grateful. There is no one else I could trust.
I hope that's not misplaced. I haven't exactly been striking off into the unknown lately.
In Florida, he's been a navigator for National Airlines, cycling between Miami, Jacksonville, Tallahassee, New Orleans, Havana, New York once in a while. Part of it's that I trust you to trust me, she says. We've never flown together, but I don't think you'll be the kind to try to take over or treat me like a novelty.
No, he says quietly. I wouldn't.
The marine layer is coming in. She is chilled, but she swirls the ice in her drink, sips.
Actually, I didn't think you'd say yes.
To coming with you? She nods.
Why did you? I didn't have anywhere better to be.
Come on.
It's the truth. First I tried going home to Michigan, then I tried Chicago, then I went down to Miami. Nothing's been quite right. He splashes more gin into her glass, then his. Maybe I'm just restless. Don't tell me you got back from the war and settled right in.
No, I wouldn't say so. In a way, she had deserted. 2 months after VE Day, in the summer of 1945, she'd ferried a plane to France. And instead of hopping a taxi plane back to Britain, she'd hitched a ride into Paris, gone on from there. The ATA didn't need her anymore anyway. She'd brought her little nest egg from saving and smuggling, the bills hidden in her rucksack and about her person. She drifted east into Germany, walked and hitched through pulverized areas populated by scarecrow people and the charred corpses of tanks and trucks, through towns and villages, even cities that appeared untouched. Soldiers in tattered uniforms walked along roadsides, and families carting all their possessions. The zones of occupation had yet to harden, and she went all the way to Berlin, watched kerchiefed women clearing rubble. From Germany, she'd gone to Switzerland, idyllic in its undisturbed neutrality, resplendent by then in autumn colors. She'd spent the winter in Italy, crossed the Mediterranean, spent a year making her way down the length of Africa, through deserts and jungles, along wide, muddy rivers. She took up with a man in Bechuanaland. One evening, in the Namib Desert,
They watched a line of desert elephants walk along the rim of a sand dune. The animals and the sky behind them were red with dust. Marianne found herself relishing the prospect of making camp, having a drink and a fire, going to bed with the man. From the sweetness that ran through her, she knew she had emerged from the war. She wasn't free of it, but she never would be. She made her way to Cape Town, caught a ship for New York. When they sailed, she stood on deck looking to the south, in the direction of Antarctica, marveling that the only thing between it and her was water. "It took me a long time to come back," she says to Eddie. "But that's another story. When I finally did, I went to Missoula to look for a friend, and instead I found Matilda's letters. They'd kept them at the post office. There had been a letter from Sarah in Seattle, too. After she'd read that Jamie had a daughter, she'd folded the papers up again and pushed them away, shocked by the force of her grief. She'd been in Caleb's cabin. He was, of course, the friend she'd come looking for. But he'd been gone to Hawaii for months. No one knew if he planned to return." "So your body came back," Eddie said, "but your mind was already running away again." "I don't know if I'd call this running away." "What is it, then? Why do the flight?" "Everyone wants to know why. I don't know. Come on." If they are extraordinarily lucky and also don't make anything except the best possible decisions at all times, they will complete what they are setting out to do. Or they will fail. Or they will die, which is different from failure. There will be a last smash up against some mountain somewhere, or a hard flat of sand, or a cracked and jumbled glacier, or, most likely, the surface of the ocean that kills with its hardness and then softens and swallows, hiding the evidence. Sometimes she thinks she has invented the flight as an elaborate suicide. Sometimes she thinks she is immortal. She drinks. "All right, here is the best I can do. When Matilda asked what I wanted, the first thing that came into my head was this vision of flying over the poles. Every time I thought of it, I felt a burst of nerves, like there was a live wire I kept touching. But, and I'll only ever admit this to you, when I wrote and told her what I wanted, I never expected her to agree. And now I actually have to do it." Carefully, he says, "You don't, though. Not really. You could change your mind." "No, I can't." "You could, and I would understand, truly. But I can't." "You can. Matilda could sell the plane." "I'm not worried about Matilda. It's the live wire. It's still there. Maybe it's more like a cattle prod. I want to do the flight, but I dread it. I'm always thinking about what could go wrong. So much could go wrong. And now I've roped you in, too. I have free will. I didn't have to come. But she doesn't know if she wants him to exonerate her or confirm her guilt. After what happened to Ruth, she wants to say she couldn't bear it if something happened to him, too. But of course, their fates will be hitched together. If something happens to him, she probably won't have to bear it because she will also be gone. He sets down his drink. "Let's say this right now and then leave it as an established, mutually understood fact. We can't have it hanging over us. And anyway, this is the truth. Marianne, Ruth's death wasn't your fault. I'm not saying this to be kind. I've given it a lot of thought. I've even let myself blame you at times, but the blame wouldn't stick. If she'd stayed in England,
She might have crashed a different plane, or died in a car accident, or gotten hit by a buzz bomb. Plenty of people did that last year. You can't know what would have happened. Look, she was a grown woman. She made her own choices. If you thought you might cause a death every time you disappointed another person, you'd be paralyzed. Do you know how many men accidentally got their friends killed in the war? How many people died because of random, casual choices? She is looking across the patchy little lawn. Everything seems unnaturally still in the fog. Eddie says, I'm going to make it a condition of my services as a navigator that you take my line on this. I loved her too. And I'm telling you to let it go. Okay? Say okay, and we won't talk about this anymore. Marion understands that no one can ever absolve her. She says okay. It was a simple thing in the end to begin. Marion Graves. Whenuapai Aerodrome, Auckland, New Zealand, to Aitutaki, Cook Islands, 36 degrees 48 minutes south, 174 degrees 38 minutes east, to 18 degrees 49 minutes south, 159 degrees 45 minutes west, December 31st, 1949, 1,752 nautical miles flown. The slow pre-dawn glug of fuel into the tanks, the walk around, the checking of checklists, the coughing start of one engine and then the other, the roaring run-up, the heavy acceleration into lift. A circle over the aerodrome's intersecting triangles of runways and taxiways, dipping the wings. Matilda Pfeiffer on the hangar's apron, waving with both arms beside the gaggle of newspaper reporters and photographers she's summoned. Shrinking to nothing. She'd appeared one day without warning as Marion and Eddie returned from a test flight, was waiting at the aerodrome with a cameraman to document their landing, drum up some newsreel publicity. They'd stood grinning awkwardly beside the plane while the camera rolled. Then Matilda had taken them to dinner at her hotel in Auckland. The city spreads to the south as they rise. Bays and inlets eat away at the long northern finger of the North Island. Farms gridded off by belts of alders and eucalyptus pass below. Low green mountains, the shore with its wide ruffles of surf. Then water, only water. They leave on New Year's Day, but they will cross the date line on the way to the Cook Islands, returning them to 1949. They each bring only a small valise, soft-sided to save weight. Eddie will get winter things in Alaska, and additional Antarctic gear has been shipped ahead to South Africa. Marion's reindeer suit is stuffed behind one of the auxiliary fuel tanks that occupy the fuselage. The plane is silver now, its jungle green paint stripped away to save 500 pounds of weight. Its glass windows switched out for plexi. Its artificial rubber fittings swapped for natural, which won't crack as easily in the cold. 100 other changes.
It's really very chic,
Matilda Pfeiffer had pronounced upon seeing the plane's polished silver skin. Light winds, harmless clouds strewn loosely as spilled popcorn. Eddie moves between his desk and the cockpit and the plexiglass astrodome, taking his sights and making his calculations with the leisurely assurance of a tennis pro lobbing balls. He traps the sun in the sextant, hands up notes with course adjustments, plucking first Norfolk Island out of the empty blue, then Nadi in Fiji, then Apia in Samoa. Lagoons like turquoise amoebas. The bits of land scattered across the Pacific are so sparse that the existence of each island seems startling, perplexing, almost worrisome. How did this wind up here all alone? What will become of it? They had done an earlier shakeout flight to the Cooks, and he knows this tract of ocean already,
has a feel for it that runs deeper than the course plotted on his chart and pencil. He knows the airplane and its deafening drone and its gasoline reek. He knows the shape of Marion's elbow and knee visible through the cockpit doorway. He pencils his neat log of figures, updating the distance they've covered, the time they will arrive. Distance equals speed multiplied by time. Time equals distance divided by speed. He feels the lines of latitude sliding underneath like the rungs of a ladder. Watches the white caps through the drift meter, measuring the difference between where they are going and where they mean to go. That's where life is, that wedge of discrepancy. The dealership, right in the middle of Raleigh, had been easy enough to find. Halliday Cadillac, said the big revolving sign. I'd like to try the blue one, he'd said to Leo. The coupe.
Very well, sir, Leo said. Please wait here and I'll go get the keys.
Bruce Halliday was Leo's father-in-law. Everyone in Stalag Luft I had nearly starved in 1945. Would have if not for the trickle of Red Cross parcels. As the boom of artillery lumbered closer and closer from the east, the Germans had made the Kriegs dig trenches and foxholes. There had been rumors these would be their graves. Then, an American voice over the loudspeaker one May morning before dawn.
How does it feel to be free, men?
The Germans were gone. The Russians were 3 miles away. They'd all rushed out of their barracks. Eddie had found Leo in the midst of the commotion. Bear hugged him and whispered that he loved him. Leo hadn't seemed to hear. The Russians were wild and drunk and came in wagons piled high with looted linens and china and silver. They went from house to house, taking what they wanted, smashing portraits of Hitler with their rifle butts. They had girls with them who put on dancing shows for the Kriegs.
I'm out of a job,
Leo had said, watching three Russian girls in short skirts spin and spin on a makeshift stage, while a man played a concertina, clapping their hands, winding the Kriegs' howl of longing around themselves like thread around spools.
More for me,
Eddie said. Leo had given a perfunctory smile.
You don't think they'll let us keep this up, do you?
Who's they? Leo had looked perplexed, made a vague gesture encompassing the whole world beyond the partially torn down prison fence and the demolished guard towers. Eddie said,
I'd say we've earned the right to do whatever we want from here on out.
That would be nice, Leo said, and dread had settled in Eddie. They'd been airlifted to a transit camp outside Le Havre. Leo had turned distant. Avoided Eddie. One day he just disappeared, presumably on a ship home. Soon enough, Eddie got sent back too.
How does it feel to be free, men?
A year later, when he was living in New York, Eddie had received a note in the mail. Leo was marrying his high school sweetheart and going to work for her father. He was sorry he hadn't had a chance to say goodbye.
Why would you come here?
Leo had said when they'd turned out of Halliday Cadillac in the blue coupe. I'm just passing through. I got a job in Florida with the airlines.
I mean, what do you want?
Turn left up here. I wish you would have told me this was what you were planning, the whole boring charade.
You have a wife.
Actually, she died in a plane crash. I didn't find out until I came home. And you know that was different. Leo touched his shoulder, just for a second.
I'm sorry, Eddie. I'm so sorry.
We don't have to get into it. Pull over here. No one comes this way. They were on a narrow road lined with forest. Eddie, too tall for the little car, swiveled as best he could to look at Leo in his unfashionable suit. His tie clip and wedding ring and short, almost military haircut.
Does your wife know?
Leo looked out the window into the trees.
She's a good soldier. We have two little girls.
He shifted,
pulling his wallet from his back pocket and extracting a snapshot. Two toddlers in dresses and sandals. They're beautiful, Eddie said, handing back the photo. Yeah. I guess I just wanted to see you again. Eddie slid his hand along the seat, stopped short of touching Leo. You were right. Things haven't changed. Not in the way I'd hoped. Everyone's so desperate to pretend we weren't all just murdering each other 5 minutes ago that there's no room for anything but the picket fence and baby carriage. We're all going to grit our teeth and be happy. Pretty much. You're not surprised. I envy that. I wish I'd never hoped. Leo put his hand on top of Eddie's. Who would have thought I'd have the most fun of my life in a German prison camp? You couldn't get away, could you? Just for a couple of days? Leo hesitated. Just when he seemed about to answer, a car passed, and he jerked his hand away. He said, You aren't really looking to buy a car, are you? The coral runway on Aitutaki was built during the war and is plenty long and has a radio beacon. Too easy, Eddie says when they've landed. Maybe this won't be such an adventure. It won't be like this the whole way, Marion says. No, he agrees. They have rooms at a thatched and stilted little inn on the lagoon where they'd stayed during their shakeout flight. Going out tonight? The innkeeper asks them. New Year's Eve? There's a pub down the road. He'd been a CB in the Navy, had helped build the runway and come back after the war. It's paradise, he'd explained, incredulous anyone would ask why. Eddie says no to the pub. At sunset, he swims in the lagoon. The surface is glassy flat, mirroring the lurid pink and purple sky, the first few stars. He can see the distant white flutter of surf breaking on the reef, and hear, muffled and delayed, the ocean roaring to be let in. The lagoon's sandy floor is pronged with dead coral and so densely populated with black sea cucumbers, it is nearly impossible to take a step without feeling one squish underfoot. He'd sold the blue coupe to some slick California lawyer who's now unwittingly zipping around Long Beach in a totem of lost love. He stands waist-deep and closes his eyes. He'd had some rum before his swim. He thinks he can feel the planet turning. The immensity of the ocean troubles him. This is something he can't tell Marion. In the war, his worst fear, worse than burning, worse than a parachute failing, was drowning. He tries to think what the next land would be in the direction he's facing, more or less due east. Maybe some tiny island. More likely, South America, thousands of miles away. An aerial navigator, the Army Air Corps manual had said, directs an aircraft from place to place over the surface of the Earth, an art called aerial navigation. He'd liked the word art, how it had been underlined. He'd liked the idea of himself directing the aircraft. Transplanted sullenly to a navigation classroom after he'd washed out of pilot training, he'd heard more words he liked. Celestial observation, dead reckoning, drift, vector, point of recognition. Symbols had peppered the maps. Cities, airfields, railroads and abandoned railroads, lakes and dry lakes, ovals for racetracks and little oil derricks, red stars for flashing beacons. Tidy reductions, pleasantly simple. Until he'd been shot down, he'd believed in his art, in a true relationship between three-dimensional space and printed maps, in the possibility of accurately saying, I am here. But after the war, no matter how far he traveled, he felt stuck, marooned, immobile. There must be another trajectory he hasn't yet found,
More equations besides the ones he knows. Another, more elusive dimension underlying the mappable world. Inevitably, we will omit almost everything. In flying the length of Africa, for instance, we will only cover one track as wide as our wings, glimpse only one set of horizons. Arabia and India and China will pass unseen to the east, and the great stretched-out Soviet beast with its European snout and Asian tail. We will see nothing of South America, nothing of Australia or Greenland or Burma or Mongolia, nothing of Mexico or Indonesia. Mostly, we will see water, liquid and frozen, because that is most of what there is. Marion Graves. Oahu, Hawaii, 21 degrees 19 minutes north, 157 degrees 55 minutes west. January 3rd, 1950, 4,141 nautical miles flown. Caleb has grown his hair long again, but wears it in a ponytail at his nape now rather than a braid. Loose strands flying around his face as he steers his truck up the windward coast, singing to himself. Marion can't catch the words. Outer window, jumbled black lava rock rambles into the sea, scraping the waves to white shreds. She sticks out her hand and the wind arches up under it like a cat's back. On Caleb's side, a fluted wall of rock, the island's steep green mountain spine. Mauka, toward the mountain. Makai, toward the sea. Hawaiian words Caleb has taught her. She and Eddie had thought they might fly the whole way from Aitutaki to Hawaii, but decided instead to stop halfway at Christmas Island and the Line Islands, a huge flat T-bone of an atoll, nearly naked except for coconut palms, a few villages, an airstrip from the war. Land crabs skittered everywhere. They had spent the night, left before dawn. She's grateful Oahu has heft and height, a lush and shaggy green pelt. Caleb is taking her to see the ranch where he works as a cowboy, a peniolo. When he'd first come, he'd worked on a taro plantation, but he prefers this. In his house, she'd noticed a photo of him sitting on a horse, a garland of pink flowers wrapped around his hat. He stops at a 5-bar gate, and she gets out and opens it, closes it again behind the truck. When she's climbed back in, he says, "Eddie seems all right." Eddie had claimed he wanted a nap, stayed behind at Caleb's place, a small blue house on stilt, almost at the water's edge. Marion thinks he is considerately giving them space, but also supposes he's not anxious to spend time with the man Marion had chosen over Ruth. Marion says, "I'd be lost without him." She smiles, pleased with herself.
"Navigator jokes. Is that what we've come to?"
A man on a horse crosses the dirt road ahead of them, lifts a hand. His vaquero saddle is small and flat, cushioned by a wool blanket.
"That guy was on Utah Beach," Caleb tells Marion. "You can see his hat sits funny because his ear got shot off."
All the other peniolos are native Hawaiian, he says. But they tolerate him because he's good with horses and only half white, and because word of his war has gotten around. The ranch house, low and long and built from blocks of coral and roofed with red tiles, sits beneath the mountains on an undulating lawn of vibrant electric green. The branches of immense monkey pod trees hover in perfect domes. Caleb drives past, into a narrow valley and through a maze of paddocks, stops at a barn. Caleb puts rope bridles on the horses, but no saddles. He takes off his boots before he mounts and makes Marion do the same. She understands why when, after they ride back the way they'd come, Makai, and cross the road onto a beach,
He rides straight into the sea. The roan shoulders of her short, willful mare move in front of Marion's knees. Her bare feet swing below the animal's belly as she breaks into a rushed, jolting jog, anxious not to be left behind, whinnying at Caleb's horse, chasing after it into the water. Marion hasn't been on a horse since she left Barclay. She bounces off balance, rights herself. The mare wades through the low surf, straining against the drag, white spray breaking against her chest. When Marion is submerged to her waist, she feels the animal become buoyant. Her lower body lifts off, and she is stretched out along the horse's back, reins loose, clutching the coppery mane. The mare's head is high out of the water, and she snorts softly in rhythm with her churning legs.
"She's swimming," Marion calls out to Caleb, giddy.
He turns. His same old amusement flashes from under his hat, his certainty that she loves him.
"What tipped you off?"